James, Rule 43.
So, I appointed a certain chaps to stand outside certain doors and look at the other day, and we went in with a camera on them. And we pointed out where they were, and those were sleeping. But some were awake, and they began to sort of suspect things. Giving a couple of really short. We rounded them all up. They were naked, some were naked, sleeping in bed with their women, some were women, their wives with them as well. And they were very surprised, I think, with our sort of sudden appearance and everything else. We were warned they could well have arms and knives, but they didn't fight everything like that. They surrendered. We told them to come. Some of them were naked. We didn't even allow them to stand there and get dressed. We told them, get your clothes and walk with your clothes. And we pushed them into the trucks. Efficiently, we filled the trucks with them all, and they were naked. November 1946. It was cold as well. And they got dressed in the trucks. And we eventually recovered all that were there. We didn't get a chance with them.
About how many were there, do you think?
Oh, there must have been, we put about 15 in each truck. So there must have been about 6:15 to 19. It must have been 19:20. It's a long time now.
What did you feel at the time about what you were doing?
I was so brainwashed by this Red Brigade officer from AFHQ who said that they had escaped from Austria. We did with a story at the time, you see. That the people in Austria, like the University of Delos, have also turned their backs and allowed them to escape because they were going to be shot. As soon as they arrived into the room, we didn't know that, and I didn't know it. But we were informed that they were traitors. They were fighting this war with the Germans, and they had committed atrocities and stuff like that. And Joe Stalin had at Yalta arranged with Churchill and Roosevelt to have them all sent back to him, and he would release certain people into Russian prison. In exchange, and Churchill's orders, these were, and Roosevelt's orders, that they were to be rounded up and sent back. So I thought, well, and I was told, don't stop. If they want to get out for them to do their formal physical functions, they have not to do so. Buckets, they had buckets in the cages. We'd only stop if our soldiers wanted to stop to urinate or something. I wanted to stop and certainly not to unlock any cage gate until we arrived at this American piece of war camp in Pisa. And he was only responsible for the convoy to arrive there safely and for these orders to be obeyed because they were terrorists. Anyway, we set off about 3 in the morning from Modena and we knew that we were going a long way and we had nobody. Have a second ashes or anything. We had to go over the spine of Italy, the Apennini, the Emiliano Apennini. It's got a mountain range. Oh God. And there was wolves there these very days, the Abruzzi. And then you go over these high mountains and it got colder and colder. A blizzard blew up, snow. And we trundled, very slowly. Over the Apennines and down. I did that map of the route at the time. I've since studied the route. It's about 140, 150 miles to Pisa, and the tortuous road, slow road. And we eventually traveling all day without any food. They were begging it to stop, especially the women in the cages. They wanted no, you do it there in the bucket. No, I'm not stopping for anybody. No. And they knew that my word was law. And, we stopped once or twice with the chaps. But no, nobody was to be allowed out. And we arrived and eventually, just before dusk, arrived in peace on this course. I remember passing the blinking, gleaming car. And arriving, the drivers knew that this prison war camp was because they'd been to the forums in these trucks. It was a vast American prison war camp. They had taken over a piece of race course. It was wonderful to see. They had great big square tents in long lines for their own staff, electric light, blackboards and whatnot. They had an enormous hall as they had for the child food hall, and also for evening dances with the local women. And that on our right hand side were all the cages with the prisoners of war. And when we arrived at this camp, we arrived in this long sort of entrance, and all the jetties realized we were British. And they started to shout against the Americans, and they shouted among themselves, the British, the English here, English, and they started to scream, and they were hysterical, shouting all sorts of things about the Americans being worse than them, and that they were making slaves of their black soldiers, and so on. And there was a crescendo, screaming mad, dyed-in-the-wool Nazis screaming at us as well, pandemonium. But anyway, we were all amused. But they didn't know that we had the bloody Cossacks on board. We could see it's dusk, it was still sort of, and it is snowing now. Anyway, I reported to the camp commander's office, he came out and he said, we'll be waiting for you. And see what it was all about. He said, right, you guys, you've done your job. He said, I'll think of these, yeah? He said, I'll get the top sergeant and above in a cab and see you. He said, you must all be, have you had any food today? None of us had had any food. From 3 a.m, this is now about, this was now in November, at dusk about 4 or 5 p.m. I said, we're all starving. He said, right. He said, leave these to us, we do that. And the sergeant, the top sergeant came and said, right. Come with me, you guys. And he looked in every tent where there were two beds and a pole, electric light, backboards. Some had a spare bed. One broke in there. He says, right, one guy in here. Right, another guy in here, you know. And he put us all up. And I said, right, before you, we're going to have a meal in a half an hour. I want to see you outside the dining hall in a half an hour's time. Don't bother to have a wash. Be there. Half an hour's time. So I said, and then you'll see where we are. I said, I don't want to lose control of you chaps, because once you've left me, if I won't tell you anything, I said, straight away, see you outside the mess hall in about half an hour. You wash your hands, whatnot. I said, and also, tomorrow morning at 7:30, I want to see you outside the dining hall. If you have any orders for you. I said, we've got to get back. And I said, these vehicles are the ones who can take us back. So anyway, the blizzard got worse, and the American commandant said, you won't be able to go to leave until this blizzard abates. And he said, you'll be here at least for 2 or 3 days. However, eventually, I discovered that every one of these American members of the war camp had been able to buy cheap, at the giveaway price, cheap, and they ordered a jeep each, because the war was over, and they didn't want to do these jeeps. They ordered a jeep each, and they had free petrol, and some of them were so clever that they made these jeeps with the canvas things into marvelous custom-made bodies of different designs, and you know, they weren't too light, but they were very, very clever. Every American is tearing around the camp with like demons with these jeeps, with a lady of the town at the his left as well. They all had a piece of comfort, shall we call it. Anyway, we eventually, in the half an hour, met us at Chow Hall, which, as I said, was used as well as a dance hall sometimes. There's a piano there, there was some tables, and we were going to have a good meal. All laid on. But on the way, we saw these signs. Take her to your tent. Be careful, she might be a hot one. There's another one there. Wise guys use a condom. You know? Another one there. Don't forget your prophylactics. And all that. So, cast the dark, but we saw these signs. There's a fisherman to see them, and then we had a very good meal, a marvelous meal, and we all went back to our tents. And I said, St. Thursday morning. Morning, morning. Well, in the middle of the night, I was so tired. I went to sleep anyway. There was an American in the bed over there, and he had electric light in the fair dog in the switch, and he had packets and packets of 200 camels and whatnot. And he says, you smoke like me, he says, you want a packet of that? And he threw a whole carton to me of camels, which was going to be saved, because I'm a smoker in those days. So I thought, yep, I could smoke. So I had these packets of 200 camels, which was good straight away. Anyway, I went to sleep and I hit the hay and this bed. I can't remember. I think I took my boots off, but I can't remember because it was so bloody cold as well. I think I sort of slept with my uniform. But anyway, about 3 in the morning, and it was blinding light that woke me up. And I opened one eye, and I saw this bot legged woman standing by my bed. And she'd go up, and she'd look at me, and she'd have a cigarette, and this American said, he realized I was awake, and he says, there's a woman there for your money. I just had a. I said, that's the last thing I want. I said, I'm bloody exhausted. I said, I don't want a woman. I said, all I want is effing sleep. He said, gee, the guy's nuts. And I said, fuck off. I was so annoyed. And he's calling me lying, and I was a sergeant major, you know. And he said, gee, the guy's nuts. And I went back to sleep. Well, anyway, the following morning, he gone, and God didn't believe us. We went to the mess hall for breakfast. And at the end of each long line of tents was a VD tent, marked VD treatment. And they were all queuing up the bloody treatment. So I said to my blokes, I said, did you see that? They're all queuing up the bloody VD treatment. I said, whatever you do, give it your bloody trousers. But I think that half of them already done it because they didn't want bloody breakfast. I don't know what transpired because after 3 days we said goodbye to this bloody place and it was, well, alarmed by the American authorities. Every soldier had a prostitute in his bloody tent every night. Well, I've been back to Pisa since, and I think there are those bloody prostitutes of those days, because the American army, that camp was vast, and they were all there. There must have been thousands of prostitutes in that camp. It was condoned and allowed by the American authorities, by the American CO. You know, can you imagine that happening to the British Army? We were all amazed. We never stopped talking about it on the way back. You know, how different it was, the discipline and what they were allowed to do in the American Army.
Just backtracking a little bit, I think you mentioned off the table a visit to Rome when you were shocked by
when I was down in the IRTD in the South of England, in 1945, Rome fell after Cassino. I went to Rome in March 45. It had fallen only weeks earlier. So the world must have fallen in the early part of 1945. And of course when they backed off from Cassino, then Anzio happened. And when they eventually, after 8 months at Cassino, fell back and Rome was declared an open city. It wasn't to be bombed, it wasn't to be shelled, it wasn't to be it was liberated by the Allies. There's a story about the Americans saying to Alexander, Mark Clark, saying, because the British wanted to take Rome, but no, the Americans said, they'll take Rome. And can you believe it? Well, I can't believe it, but it was reported. But the American commander says, If there are any British guys in Rome, we'll shoot them before us. What?
Were you aware of this at the time?
We were all aware of it, all the Americans.
So there was the resentment.
We were under Mark Clark, Fifth Army, you see, initially, right? And there came a time when Monty came up. And Monty was supposed to take Rome, and Alexander wanted to take Rome. And Mark Clark said, if there's anybody in Rome before us, we'll shoot the guys. Now, that's not being a fair ally. And we turned against the Yanks for that. That is what he said. Can you believe it? One general to another. Arguing about who's been Rome first. Anyway, it was declared an open city, and eventually I was selected for a little rest, a holiday, in this new rest camp that opened in Rome.
And this is while you were at the IRT?
I was at the IRTV in the South, in March 45. Now, we had come over from Italy, from Philippi in 1944, in the winter. Then, of course, this is August, October, November. But so, I'd been doing this for 6 months, by the way, seeing the job shop, and it was a hard task. They sent me to Rome to be one of the first to enjoy a week's holiday in his rest camp. So I went with one or two others. And of course, when we got to Rome, this lovely rest camp, which is new and set up and beautiful, the food was marvelous. There was nothing at all except go out and see the sights. Wonderful. So I thought it was great. The food was marvelous as well. Anyway, we were told as well that all the women at the box in Rome are following the jellies and not to build them a tour. Well, so I met up with Sergeant Major, who was there, from the Rifle Brigade. His name was Charlie Sandler. And we decided, two more boxes, last two together, to accompany each other to go down to the sites. And we went out to explore Rome. And the first thing that happened to us was, we were walking down, there's no transport in there because there's no bloody petrol. The roads are all empty. It is a strange, silent place with hardly any traffic at all. That was the first impression I got. And Charlie and I were walking together, and we were on our way to the Vatican City. And we said, look out, with shorts on. March, with shorts on. He said, and I tell him, he said, look out. He said, look what's coming towards us. And there were about 8 or 9 or 10 women arm in arm with fur coats on, prostitutes. Oh, some of them must have been about 30, 50, because you could see under the makeup, the powder, and the makeup and the paint. Oh, you could see we were bloody rock, you know. But some of them were nice and young as well. So they were arm in arm, and they were all prostitutes. And there was a queue waiting. I said there was no traffic, but there was a queue waiting at the bus stop because there was no bloody buses coming for a bus or something. They were laughing their heads off. Anyway, these prostitutes came up in front of us, and I didn't fancy them at all. No child, because we didn't want to read as well. You know, we'd be warm in the bloody cap. The old pox, you see. So one of them came in front of me. And without any warning at all, put a bloody hand up my shorts, trouser leg, pants on, and got over my John Thomas, through my pants. And she said, oh, he's forte. I mean, he's got the horn. Like, far from the truth, but she was pulling me like hell across the road with a bloody hand up my trouser leg. But I didn't know whether it was a chopper or what, or kicker, but I was so dumbfounded, I eventually got her and pushed her out of my bloody arms and she fell back in the world. But these Italians standing at the bus stop were laughing business, were laughing to her. And old Charlie Saddles, he couldn't go live with another lot. Anyway, I got away and Charlie and I started, we had a run from the bus. And, and we would we were two young dog officers, Bill Schultz, I remember, old Gettler. I said to him, yes, the person had the best of Bill Schultz in Rome. For Islam. He didn't wear those shorts anymore. After that, we had long, KB long gone. But that was the very first thing that happened to us in Rome. That was a memory, an undying memory. And I've never forgotten it. But on our way down to the Vatican City anyway, we were accosted several times by all sorts of reasons. Oh dear. And we wouldn't touch more basketball because it was very, very, very well known, you know, that it was a terrible place to be at that time, following the Germans and whatnot. But when we arrived at the Vatican City, we were wandering, and we went up the side of the enormous St. Peter's, where there was Christians, and then at that time, they were uniforms mainly, but they were dressed in these comical sort of clown uniforms, you know, and they said, who spoke English, said, in here. The Pope is coming in here in a few seconds and he wants to meet as many British Tommies as possible. He took us in there. I think the English is really important. Because, well, I can't describe it, but the scenic, the ancient painting on it was beautiful. And in he walked, obviously, immediately with the entourage and came in front of me, standing right in front of me, a foot away. And he blessed me, and he said, peace be with you. I hope that you will all be very, very quickly home with your families, and this war is over. But of course, since then, there's been stories about Pope Pius XII, who's a tall, thin bloke with a long, hooked nose and little glasses, little lenses, and there's a story that he was known as Hitler's Pope because he didn't condemn the concentration camps. Mm. So I went away back and told him all that I had an order to the Pope, or at least he spoke to me. They never didn't believe me, nobody would believe me, but it's absolutely true. I've since been back to Rome for a holiday as a civilian with my wife. And we had a guy take us around St. Peter's, and we came to this little monument of Pope Pius XII now in the main hallway of St. Peter's. And he was describing, first of all, La Pietà, the wonderful sort of thing in St. Peter's where you see Virgin Mary with Christ down from the cross. And then next to him is the Pope Pius XII statue. So he said, the guide said, here's Pope Pius XII. In the war, he made it his duty to speak to as many Allied soldiers as possible. Although he was known as Hitler's Pope, he was also well known for his, when Rome fell, for his friendliness with British troops. And he made it his duty to speak to as many as possible. So my wife said, he spoke to my husband. He spoke to your husband. He was here. Where's your husband? Here. Here is one soldier who spoke to the Pope, or the Pope spoke to in 1945 in March. That just bears out. He said, this is the first time I've seen anybody who could say that he spoke to the Pope. Thank you, madam. Thank you, sir. Amazing, isn't it?
And off the tip, you mentioned something about in the ruins. What was that? You were surprised when you were in Rome.
In Rome?
In the Colosseum or something.
Oh,
wasn't
well, every night we went to the opera. Now, that was my initiation into opera. I'd heard before the war, Il Trovatore. That was my mother's favourite music before the war. Il Trovatore was very famous as part of the opera in Wales. But I had no idea of any opera at all, but we went to the opera and I saw Tosca. The stage in the Teatro Real, the Royal Theatre in Rome, is the best in the world for opera. The stage was back about 300 feet. And of course with Tosca, they're on the top of the Castello San Angelo, and the Scarpio, he's the greatest sort of raper, you know. And I had her husband in prison.
and she jumps from the ground parapet of this castle Durango into the tiger, you see. But then they've got this set on the stage. It was so realistic. Rome was on the set, going back 300 feet. St. Peter's, the Castello San Angelo here in front. It was Rome, and the stars were shining brightly. Now, there's an aria in Tosco, in Luce Vanistelle. The stars are shining brightly. It's the most beautiful bit of music. And you look at the darkness of Rome, with the stars shining brightly. And there they are on top of this castle parapet. Check his leg in the river in a minute. But before she does it, dawn comes very, very gradually, and then the lighting. Darkness fell, the stars gradually disappeared, and dawn came over the rooftops of Rome, and it was so realistic, I've never forgotten the beauty of it. The spill, the lighting, the Italian production of Tosca in, oh God, it was fantastic. I've drooled about it, I've told thousands about it since, and I love opera, I love Tosca, and I've seen Tosca since, scores of times, but never so well as produced that production in Rome.
And that was it mainly soldiers in the audience?
Oh, yes, and we had this fantastic special for the prisoner war camp, not prisoner war camp, rest camp. I think it's about the equivalent in lira of 5 bob. So I went every night, and I saw a different opera every night. Tosca was the first one. Aida was fantastic, with all the Egyptian sort of scenes of the horses. But the scales are so vast that nobody could get opera like the Romans.
And what was it popular with the troops?
Everybody, it was full every night. It was great. To go every night in this wonderful opera house. And the troops, we were told about it as we were at the rest camp. We were allowed to go to the opera, grand opera, for about 5 bob, read every night. Oh, yes, it was an education. It really gave me an insight into opera. And I saw almost every opera. Well, I was there for a week, and I read every night. Yeah, I saw 7 different operas. It was great. I never forgot that. Now, the other thing was that we explored the Colosseum. Now, the Colosseum it's fantastic, and it was one mass of grey ash when we were there at the war, and all these sort of, many bits have disappeared. Half the Colosseum is no longer there. It's been shown up and repointed and bricked and so on. But we climbed as young soldiers, we didn't stay down on the terra firma, we climbed up the walls and got around the top part of the Colosseum to walk around where people don't go these days, and walked around in the archways and looked out down on the road. And we finally explored the Colosseum by climbing up as soldiers. We climbed up walls and we sort of got up a height. And in every alcove, there was a prostitute on her back on the floor with a bloody Indian Army soldier on the job with his turbans. And we were stepping over them. They were so numerous that the Colosseum, when we were there, was where the prostitutes did their business. And the Indian Army, they stuff anything they could. But I'm not kidding, the Indian Army were there in force. 4th Indian Div, I think it was. And they were there at that time, and we were there in March 1944. And they were all on the job in the Colosseum. And whenever I think I'll be back since, I can only see the Indian Army on the job. The Colosseum, come on, almighty. I mean, they didn't, with all the warnings as well. Never forgotten.